The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
Missouri Democrats often have a hard time pushing the policy needle in the Missouri General Assembly. But as State Representative Kevin Windham found out, his caucus was able to make a serious mark in a budgetary process that could have major implications for the future. The Uplands Park Democrat joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to break down what he contributed to the 2023 budget and his take for how his party is situated for the upcoming election cycle. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me in Jefferson City, she is St. Louis Public Radio State House and politics reporter
Sarah Kellogg.
And joining us, a longtime fan of the show. He's one of the people that's in the intro music, which I know is probably the biggest accomplishment of your life.
That's right. Kevin Windham, District 85 State Representative. Thanks for having me, Jason.
And welcome back. Just remind our listeners what your district is and what it will look like after redistricting.
Yeah. So the 85th District right now is more than 20 municipalities in the Normandy School District and a couple of municipalities in the Ritner School District. So think mostly the Normandy School District and St. John, St. Anne, and a little bit of Overland. That's my current district. So after redistricting, it's a little bit more Normandy-centric, which I think is a good thing. So I will no longer have it will now be the 74th district, and there will no longer be Pineline and Northwood, sadly. But the district will gain Wellston, Pagedale, Vanita Park, Vanita Terrace. It's going to be, again, a lot of the Normandy School District.
So how did this past session compare to the others you've taken part in?
So every session has been unique thus far, and everyone has been just a whirlwind. But this one, it has been a bit of a more drawn-out whirlwind. So my first session, of course, it was, I think the expression is drinking from a fire hose. The second session, 2020, was, again, trying to learn the ropes, but we also had an outgoing speaker that was trying to get a lot of priorities done. And then 2021 was marred by coronavirus mostly. And this year was marred by the Senate, mostly the conservative caucus. So I felt like most of this session, the Senate took up most of the air in the room, and really the House was just trying to do a delicate dance of keeping up with the Senate and trying to make sure to appease them in some ways.
What do you think could be done to prevent another session like 2022 from happening again?
Well, that's a deep question, Sarah. Thank you for it. To keep it short, I think that really we need to keep politics out of policy as much as possible. So that's broad, and I know it is, but I think that's what really happened this session. A lot of political grandstanding about a 7-1 map that a lot of folks knew was never going to happen, just so they can have a little bit more of a positioning when it came to getting a map that was more favorable to them. And really, I'm talking about the conservative caucus and Senator Onder and especially taking the lead in that.
Do you see this as a House Senate issue, or are there flaws in the House that make relations with the Senate worse?
So I think that this session, it was a lot of the Senate, quite honestly. I think that the House has a lot of its own intricacies that kind of play into that dynamic. I've been known for lamenting about the previous question motion and how I think that it's overused in the House. So that really puts a lot of onus on the Senate.
And the previous question is when you basically stop debate on a bill. And it's done in the House pretty frequently, but in the Senate, it's considered like, quote unquote, the nuclear option that kills a lot of other things after it's done.
That's right. Thank you for that, Jason. So when the previous question motion is used so often in the House, that puts a lot of onus on the Senate in order to make sure that they do a lot of the due diligence that we don't have the wherewithal or the time, either one, to do in the House. So, again, that just kind of all plays into each other. I don't know that it's one quick fix that the House can take to fix that, or the Senate can take to fix that, other than just, again, broadly not making politics such a big part of our policymaking.
We recently had Representative Joe Adams on the show, and he said, you know, kind of the dysfunction in the Senate kind of made its way to the House, where, you know, you mentioned the previous question, but there were times where the House kind of spun their wheels on maybe one, two bills a day and let, you know, so many amendments on a long debate. And then there were other bills that were cut off that, you know, there was definitely a kind of a desire for more debate. You know, do you agree with that consensus? And why do you think that happened?
Yeah, I think this very observative of Representative Adams, and I felt the same way, even that at some points in the session, I'm thinking about when there was an omnibus election bill and there was an amendment added to talk about transgender athletes in high school sports. So I think that there was a lot of times where there was a big issue in front of us, and then there was a very polarizing issue that was thrown on top of that, and we spent a lot of time as a body talking about the more polarizing issue, where we still had a huge underlying issue underneath that. And then with the previous question motion being used, we don't get to have that full robust debate.
We'll talk more about specifics in the budget about how Democrats were impactful. But overall, how do you think your fellow Democrats fared, considering how outnumbered you are?
House Democrats came out well, and you'll hear a lot of folks saying that. I don't think I've heard anybody say anything otherwise so far. Of course, there were some big priorities that House Democrats and even Senate Democrats wanted to push forward, but those didn't go through. But at the same time, we had a very successful budget year, and I'm looking forward to talking more with you about that. But I think that it really came down to a lot of relationship building, but also just having good policies and good explanations for the policies and a good reason why we were pushing those policies and what results we expect to see.
So let's talk about that budget. There's a lot to talk about there. You serve on the House Budget Committee, and Democrats were largely very happy with how that process turned out. How do you feel your caucus fared in influencing the debate this year?
You'll see that Democrats had a lot of successes, even on the House floor, which hasn't happened in past years. But you'll also find that, like you said, Democrats were able to influence the conversation on quite a few things. So I think about the land grant with Lincoln. So the Lincoln has never had a full land grant since I can tell. As far as I know, they've never had a full land grant. So this year we fully funded the land grant, and that was because of a lot of conversation that has been had on a bipartisan level. But I think that especially when it came to the budget this year, being able to look at the University of Missouri's land grant line item compared to Lincoln University's land grant item, it was pretty clear that there was some deficiencies in funding there.
How do you feel that funding is going to help Lincoln University? And what do you think needs to be done for HBCUs so that they have a stable source of funding?
Yeah, so it is... It's going to do a lot for Lincoln, but I think that it's going to have the same great impact for the state of Missouri overall. So the money that's going to be going to Lincoln's land grant is going to be going towards research. So it's not really going to be the labs that everyday students get to see when they go to class. Lincoln has some very impressive hemp studies that they're doing, and it's also going to help with the extension of Lincoln University. So a lot of folks don't know, but Lincoln University is a big presence in the Boot Hill of Missouri, and they have extension programs where they take kids and teach them how to farm, or they take kids and just make sure that they have a great experience, even with there not being very many resources there in the way of higher education institutions, with the exception of my alma mater, Southeast Missouri State.
Go Red Hawks.
That's right.
You said on the House floor, you know, with this land grant match, you know, this makes up for this year, but it doesn't make up for prior years. So what do you think needs to be done for HBCUs, other universities, so they have this stable source of funding?
Yeah, so I have a couple answers to that. I think that, first of all, this only makes up for this year, and that's good. But we still have to think about the past years where Lincoln has pulled money out of their core budget, which is the money that students see when they walk in the classroom every day, and putting it towards their land grant line item. So we need to make up for that. That equals out to the tune of over $40 million just in from about 2008 to 2018, if I'm not mistaken. And we also need to look at funding overall for our institutions. While I'm not in favor of a performance funding formula, I do think that it's a shame to look at how we fund our university, seeing that Southeast Missouri State University and the University of Central Missouri have about the same amount of students, but Southeast Missouri State gets about $10 million less per year, year over year. So I think that we need to take a look at how we fund all of our institutions, but especially our historically Black colleges and universities in the state.
What are some, besides Lincoln University funding, what are some key items that you were able to get into the budget?
Yeah, so in terms of just kind of influencing the conversation, one thing that I was not directly responsible for was two new post investigators in the Department of Public Safety. So post investigators look at the investigation that an officer was involved in or was a party to. And they say if the police officer should keep their post license or not. Prior to this year, there were two post investigators for the entire state. I filed a bill a couple years now that would up that to one post investigator per administrative hearing commissioner. And that was language that was fine-tuned. It was initially supposed to be eight, which would be one per congressional district, and we narrowed that down to six, which would be one per administrative hearing commissioner. This year in the budget, two additional administrative hearing commissioners were funded. So that's one win in the budget. Also, I was responsible for proposing an amendment to add $3.5 million to the Bright Flight program, which is a scholarship for folks that have a high ACT score, and $4.5 million for the Access Missouri Scholarship Program, which is a grant for high-need students that go to post-secondary.
So Senator Brian Williams noted that he was able to get a lot of money for St. Louis County, North St. Louis County. I believe, Jason, we have a clip queued up.
I think that's the bright spot to the session. I mean, we're going to bring record appropriations throughout the state, especially to the St. Louis region. I'm extremely proud to have been able to fully fund transportation for the first time, which will help Bi-State and other public transit organizations. And then we've been able to invest in a workforce development project right in North St. Louis County on the UMSL South Campus, which that area has not received any investment in roughly several decades in Jamestown Mall. To be able to get money into Jamestown Mall to do that demolition, which has been an eyesore in North St. Louis County for a very long time.
How do you think these funds are going to help the county that you represent?
Wow. So I have been quoted as saying that these are once in a lifetime funds. Speaking about the funds that local communities received in order to recover from the coronavirus pandemic, and these are the type of once in a generation projects that will really shape how our community looks going forward. So I'm very proud of the work that the legislature was able to do. Spearheaded by Senator Williams when talking about the UMSL Revitalization Project, when talking about the demolition of Jamestown Mall, which both have been projects that have needed to be done for quite some time now. So these are the projects that, again, changed the entire landscape of a community, but they're also the type of projects that I love because they affect people that don't think that politics have anything to do with them. So the folks that say that I don't do politics, they're going to ride past that brand new economic development project near the University of Missouri, St. Louis, and they're going to know that politics has a lot to do with them.
One of the big surprises, at least to me, was that the issue of Medicaid expansion funding, which was a huge issue in 2021, kind of was not as big of an issue in 2022. Were you surprised by that as well?
Yes and no. So I was surprised that actually there was still some attacks on Medicaid expansion, especially by Representative Smith, which had a House joint resolution to undo Medicaid expansion or to be able to defund it. But I'm not surprised that it wasn't very many more attacks because I think that the judiciary pretty much wheeled us that way.
Because that ballot initiative didn't make it to the ballot, which effectively means that Medicaid expansion is locked in for the next 2 years, mm-hmm. at the very least, probably 3 years. At this point, considering there could be literally over 200,000 people involved in Medicaid expansion by that point, is it just politically impossible for Republicans to undo it at all? Any time in the future,
I hope so. I won't guess on that because I'm not very good at guessing. I'll say that I don't think that the political momentum will ever be there. But you know, the way that resolutions are drafted and constitutional amendments are drafted is no way of really telling. It's ways to make bad things sound good on the ballot and ways to make good things sound bad. So I hope not.
Was there anything about the budget process that you found disappointing or frustrating?
Yeah, so outside of all the wish list items that House Democrats had, and again, Democrats overall in the legislature had, we had great ideas ranging from allowing universities to pay off student debt that has been accumulated with the university to foreclosure assistance programs. But I think that personally one of the big things or two big things that I was disappointed in that actually were included in the budget was, first of all, language that says that undocumented students have to pay international rates at the university, public universities and community colleges in our state, which is about three times the rate that in-state students pay. And then secondarily, and just as head-scratching, is $10 million for deferred maintenance at charter schools, which the governor vetoed last year.
I know Democrats were upset about the process. House Democrats, at least, were upset over the American Rescue Plan funding, how that went. It was done pretty quickly. And how do you feel like that process could have gone better?
Honestly, I'm still kind of bewildered with the process. I had the honor of serving on the subcommittee on federal stimulus spending in the House, and we had quite a few hearings over the interim about how we could potentially spend this money. And I didn't see very much crossover from our committee hearings to regular session, and even from our subcommittee recommendations to the overall budget recommendations. So again, it was an honor to serve on that committee, but I don't really feel like the commitment that the committee made was really valued by the overall body and the recommendations that we ended up following through the House bill. Even when we go past the process that it took in the House, it was like House Democrats said, the Senate took it as a blank check and they rolled out a bunch of pet projects for their districts. And while they ended up good in some circumstances, again, with projects like the UMSL revitalization or the demolition of Jamestown Mall, there were also some projects that I'm sure could have used more scrutiny.
We'll be right back after this quick break with State Representative Kevin Windham.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with State Representative Kevin Windham. He is a Democrat from Hillsdale. Is that where you live?
That's right.
Okay. For some reason, some people said you lived in Uplands Park or something like that.
So I live in Uplands Park, but Hillsdale will forever be my home. That's the first home that I was brought home to, so I'll forever claim Hillsdale as my hometown.
You were one of the House Democrats who were very upset about the Senate Democrats not doing enough to stop legislation that included the resuscitation of a photo identification requirement to vote. Why were you upset?
Yeah, so I would say more so disappointed than upset because, you know, photo voter ID is something that Democrats, for a good reason, and I won't even just say Democrats, I'll say folks that are on the side of righteousness have been fighting against for many a decade, far before I was born. And to know that that's a law that passed while I served as the ranking minority member on the House Elections Committee really breaks my heart. And to know that, again, we talked about the previous question motion a little bit. So we knew in the House going in that we would get the previous question motion. But We pretty well depended on the Senate being our last line of defense in order to stave off that bill again. And to hear about the lackluster filibuster that happened in the Senate, I was just really disappointed by that. And I understand that I'm not a senator and I'm not privy to some of the conversations that happened over there. But like it was said on the House floor, if there was any hill to die on, I think that this was it.
So it's interesting you use that phrase. Senate Democrats said had they made this bill the hill to die on, it would have resulted in a worse bill, possibly without no excuse in-person absentee voting. What do you make of that argument?
I don't want to put too much pressure on Senate Democrats, but if we're going by that rationale, then the bill adding 2-week no excuse absentee in person pretty well does nothing except for allow the people that were already, finger quote, fibbing to go through the process without having to feel bad. And while that's a good measure, that's no trade-off for something that people have literally bled and died for over the years, being voting rights, not being hampered. So not only that, but the bill also included it's a Mike Lindell special. It's a disenfranchisement bill all around. So it's everything from not allowing groups to register voters without having going through a process with the Secretary of State, to not allowing local boards of elections to accept money from third-party entities like nonprofits, to again photo voter ID, to the elimination of primary elections for the presidential primary. Now we have caucuses, which is, again, could be a whole podcast about disenfranchisement. It was just so much in that bill that was no good trade in my eyes, and I would have much rather known that Senate Democrats, again, fought their hardest, like they have in the past, to kill this bill, or at least, again, try. So that was just too much for me, personally, and then knowing that there's a non-severability clause where if the photo voter ID portion is thrown out in court, the 2-week no excuse in person absentee goes with it. So it's a lot in that omnibus bill. It's not just photo voter ID, and I just don't see the 2-week no excuse as a good trade-off at all. But I will say, as a politically speaking a listener, I can say Jason Rosenbaum has been calling this for quite some time, asking people if they take that trade-off.
And yes, I
unfortunately,
have.
That's the one that it looks like the Senate Democrats were willing to make.
With exception to that bill, a lot of bills in general that House Democrats oppose ended up crashing and burning because the Senate adjourned early or due to dysfunction in the Senate. Do you expect Republicans to try again on measures to make constitutional amendments more difficult to pass?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that Republicans have shown that to be one of their priorities, not just by pushing those type of bills along on the floor, but by the sheer number of bills that they filed and the different methods by which they want to squash the initiative petition process. It's just really eye-opening, and of course I expect more of the same, and probably even more cunning attempts, if you will.
I think that one of the ways Democratic groups have gotten their initiatives past the finish line is through the initiative petition process. That's why Republicans are targeting this process right now. I think that's pretty obvious. But I also think that there is a fair argument to be made that encasing large blocks of text into the Missouri Constitution to establish certain policies is not really a good way to enact things. Like the medical marijuana situation is a great example. I know you had misgivings about Clean Missouri. We talked about that a lot. Is it a fair argument to make that it's better to go through the legislative process than to let groups just put stuff in the Constitution that may serve their own interests?
Yeah, I think it's a fair argument to make if you have a legislature that is truly responsive to the people. And although some may think that that's a tired argument, I think that it happens to be an evergreen argument. So with the Republican Party being in the supermajority now, that's a process that, like you said, it's been typically used by more progressive measures. But there was a time where there were more conservative measures put on in the Constitution by way of initiative petition. So I think that it swings both ways. And if there was a legislature that was truly responsive to what the people wanted, see medical marijuana, see even now coming soon recreational marijuana or election reform, folks know what they want and they know how to get it on the ballot. And if the legislature was A, responsive, and B, wouldn't go back and change statutes that the people have already gone to change, then I think that it might be a different story.
By the time lawmakers return to Jefferson City next year, Roe versus Wade could be overturned, which would make most abortions in Missouri illegal, with the exception of medical emergencies. Now, I've talked with people like outgoing state representative Mary Elizabeth Coleman and Sam Lee, who's a lobbyist who pushes for abortion restrictions. And they have told me the next step, if Roe falls, is actually trying to get something in the Missouri Constitution that would essentially protect the state's trigger law, which I think I just explained it, but I'll explain it again for clarity, is the mechanism that would ban most abortions if Roe versus Wade is overturned. What is your expectation about what lawmakers will do with this issue if the Supreme Court follows through on the draft opinion that got leaked a couple weeks ago?
You know, Jason, I'm not going to pretend to be very knowledgeable about this subject, especially predicting what will happen in the future. I can say that champions for women and birthing people in the state can expect me to fight against any efforts to take away anybody's autonomy over their body, especially with decisions that are so sensitive to one's autonomy of their body. I do want to briefly say that the state lost and the world lost a true champion for reproductive rights in Cora Faith Walker, and I'll take her spirit with me in any fights that have to do with reproductive justice. So thank you for the question. I don't know what it looks like going forward. I would have never thought that there would be a Texas style bounty hunter style law, and I would have never thought that Missouri legislators would try to follow suit, but that's where we are.
This past year, not only was there dysfunction, there was the passage of a congressional redistricting map. It was also an election year. With kind of those things now, what those things wouldn't be in the picture next year. What are some issues you expect to pop up in 2023 when you return to the legislature?
That's a good question. I'm still recovering from a long session this session, but I think that you alluded to one that'll certainly come up, and that is initiative petition reform. I think that that's going to loom large, especially depending on the outcome of the upcoming initiative petitions that that many people expect to make the ballot. I also think that education reform will continue to be a big topic in the legislature. And really, again, unfortunately, guns and abortion are going to be big topics, if not for the practicality of actually making good laws for the state of Missouri, then certainly for as talking points, unfortunately.
Is there anything that you have as a major priority in the next year?
So I have a couple things. I really hope to continue to have a focus on higher education in our state. But I also hope that the state legislature will take some action on revitalizing our communities, especially when we talk about home ownership and the proliferation of vacant houses in the region. I think that's something that we really need to take a deeper look at. We've shown some willingness to work on those issues. Again, I think that will really take a lot of thought. But those are a couple of the issues that I really want to hit home on.
So now we've entered the newest segment of Politically Speaking, the lightning round.
Nice.
These are not one-word answers. I guess some of them have not even been one-sentence answers. But just your answers don't have to be that long. And these are going to be on the election that is going to be coming up. So you live in the 1st Congressional District. There is going to be a race between Senator Steve Roberts and Congresswoman Cori Bush. How do you see that race shaking out?
So I think you need an extended play for all these questions. That could be a whole podcast. I'll say that it's going to be a very good race. It's going to be one to watch because I think that Congresswoman Bush has been in the media a lot. Folks know of the persona of Congresswoman Bush, and not all of those decisions have gone very smooth for her. I think that we'll have to see how the race shakes out. I hope that the race can stay, or I wish that the race could have been a battle against policy and ideologies, but there's a lot of other things at play. Sorry for the long answer.
Oh, no, that's an okay answer. And just for full disclosure, you ran against her father in 2018, who is a Northwoods alderman, and you defeated him to become state representative. Assuming both of them win their primaries, how competitive do you expect the race to be between St. Louis County Executive Sam Page and State Representative Shamed Dogan?
I expect it to be interesting. I don't know how competitive I expect it to be. I'll say that no one should sleep on Shamed Dogan's chance to win this election. However, I think it's a very steep hill to climb.
Just because the county is super Democratic now.
That's right. I think that the county is super Democratic, but I think that there was a message sent by some of the things that county voters voted on in this past election.
Do you think that any of the major Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate have a chance to win if the GOP nominee is not Eric Greitens?
Yes.
Why do you think that?
Eternal optimism.
So there are three candidates who are running that have raised significant amount of money on the Democratic side. Lucas Kuntz, Trudy Bush Valentine, presumably, like, she hasn't put a campaign report in, but she's worth quite a bit of money. And also Spencer Toter, who is an entrepreneur in St. Louis. What do you make of these candidates, and why do you think any of them would be viable?
Yeah, I think that they are good candidates on paper. I do wish that there was more of a voice for African Americans in the race. I wish that there was more of a voice for young black African Americans in the St. Louis area. And that may be a little bit egotistical for me to say, being a young black St. Louisan, but I think that there's really a voice and a lane in the race left to be filled. So hopefully one of those candidates will fill that lane.
Pivoting to state elections, how do you feel that House Democrats will fare in the upcoming election? There's an expectation that they could gain seats for the first time in a while, but will those gains be muted by a GOP wave?
Yes, and yes. So I think that there will be gains in the legislature, specifically in the House, because there are maps that are more representative of the state. However, I think that the 2022 election will inevitably be a tough election for Democrats, being a midterm election where there's a Democratic president and inflation is, by all measures, something to contend with.
My final question, and this one is a curveball. Do you have any suggestions on who should consider running for governor as a Democrat in 2024?
John Goodman, the dad from Roseanne.
Oh. Now, okay. Did you know?
I love that answer so much.
That is a great answer. Did you know that John Goodman was a major donor for the person that replaced Steve Stanger as county councilman, because they were both friends? And honestly, I don't remember the guy's name.
I had no idea about that, Jason.
I covered county council for 11 years.
There you go with another deep cut. I had no idea, but thank you for that, Jason.
Do you think that John Goodman could beat Jay Ashcroft or Mike Kehoe?
Yes.
Okay.
And yes.
Afton native, John Goodman, you're on notice.
John, hit me up, John. We'll get something together.
Thank you so much for joining us, as always, for all of our stories. Go to stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. You can follow me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. You can follow Sarah on Twitter at
Sarah K. Kellogg.
And how would people find you on Twitter or any place on the internet you want to be found?
So for now, my Twitter handle is at KWindham85, but again, my district is going to be changing, so there may be KevinWindham74 soon. So keep a lookout for that. Thanks, Jason.
Thank you very much, and until next time, so long.
And thanks, Sarah.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.